college textbooks can be expensive. The average student spends more than $1,200 a year on books and supplies. That's according to the College Board. We'll learn about the Open Textbook Network that provides students with textbooks free to read online or download. Also,
one of my favorite lines about politics is there's no such thing as a silver medal. You either win or you lose.
That's Paul Green speaking at a Chicago mayoral election preview at the City Club of Chicago. He died on Saturday at the age of 73. We'll remember him with NPR's David Shaper in our Monday Politics segment. Plus, how much do we understand what our dogs are trying to tell us?
While we're good at identifying like big signals of concern, such as growling, snapping, or biting, we tend to miss the more subtle signs.
We'll talk dog and human communication. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed their weekends. We spent a lot of time talking about the cost of college tuition, but how much about how much college textbooks cost? According to the College Board, the average student budget for books and supplies is more than $1,200 annually. A report from the nonprofit Public Interest Research Group says the cost of a college textbook has increased by 73% over the past 10 years. How much are we talking about? The report said it's not uncommon for an individual book to cost more than $200. Some have price tags that go as high as $400. Last week, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin tweeted to Illinois students telling them to ask their professors to consider using open textbooks in their classes. Right now, just one school in Illinois, DePaul University in Chicago, is part of the Open Textbook Network that includes 250 campuses around the country. Joining us today to explain more about this is the executive director of the Open Textbook Network, Dave Ernst. He's on the line with us from Minneapolis, where he teaches and is he's the chief information officer, actually, for the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. Dave, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Dave, we were just talking about this issue this morning on Reddit. One University of Illinois user told us they avoid paying for textbooks by borrowing books from friends, taking pictures of pages from friends' books, or settling for an older version of their textbooks online. What lengths have you seen students go to avoid paying for textbooks?
Well, because of the high cost, they've actually figured out a number of ways to try to survive, I guess, the college by with different strategies. They've chosen to purchase older editions. They've delayed purchasing textbooks as long as possible just to see if they can get by without them. And sometimes, quite often, they don't purchase them at all. They share them with friends. They may download digitized copies from the internet. All to kind of avoid paying the high cost, but at the same time, what they're really doing is taking some sort of academic risk by doing that.
Mm-hmm. In your opinion, what do you think's caused the rise in textbook costs, as we've looked at data that says increases of as much as 73% over the past 10 years?
Yeah, I think that's hard to say. I can't really say for sure, but I would say there has been a consolidation in the market. And there's also it's a bit of a broken market in some ways, in that it's the people paying the price are not the actual people making the decisions. So faculty are choosing the textbook and students are paying for it. So there's not a real supply and demand pressure that there are in many markets. But that's a guess on my part.
Mm-hmm. What inspired the Open Textbook Network? These things that we're talking about, I'm assuming.
Yeah, well, we saw, right, exactly. We saw that some of these strategies that students were forced to take because of the high cost are really impacting their success. And so we were seeing here, I'm in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota, where we have students who are first generation and other students who are at a bit higher risk than other students for success. And so we wanted to eliminate some of those barriers, and cost was a huge barrier. And so we started working on it here, and it has spread, as you've said, to now we have a network that includes over 250 institutions nationally.
What are open textbooks? Can you explain to us how this network works?
Yeah, open textbooks are textbooks that were funded, published, and licensed to be free and flexible. So the intent is that these are textbooks that are meant to be shared and just available to students so they can use them to learn. So eliminating all the cost issues. And when I first learned about them back in 2011, we started at just asking the question, how come faculty aren't adopting these if these things exist, these open textbooks? And that's the problem. That's the question we've been trying to answer and solve ever since. And that's where the Open Textbook Network came from, is that we've been trying to help other institutions answer those same questions and help their faculty see them as an option.
That's Dave Ernst. He's executive director of the Open Textbook Networks. We're talking about how some schools, including the University of Minnesota, are trying to cut down on these expensive costs for students with this network. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Scott Walter is the university librarian at DePaul University in Chicago, currently the only school in Illinois that is taking part in the Open Textbook Network. He's on the line with us from Chicago. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
How did DePaul University find out about the Open Textbook Network?
I was aware of open educational resources work going on at a number of institutions through the Association of College and Research Libraries, the Association of Research Libraries, but I first became more aware of the Open Textbook Network through our work with the Library Publishing Coalition, which is a group of libraries from around the country and even around the world now. That are looking at how to build publishing capacity within academic libraries. So that was where I first got more details about OTN.
And how does it work for DePaul? Does it cost the school anything to be a part of the network?
There was a price to join the network, an initial price, and along with that came access to the training and development resources that we will use with our faculty as we pursue this open textbook initiative over the coming year, and then, of course, the value of being able to consult not just with folks like Dave, but with our colleagues who are at institutions all around the country and who are at different phases of their open textbook initiative so that we can learn from their success and build on that here at DePaul.
And how many books or how many textbooks are you offering through the network right now at DePaul?
Well, we're not offering textbooks through the network per se right now. We have just we just joined the network over the summer, and school just began at DePaul last Wednesday. So what we've been doing over the last few months since we became committed to joining as a member of the network have been some foundational steps. We have been identifying some additional champions for OER use and open textbook use among our faculty, learning which of our faculty members are currently using open textbooks, and beginning to put into place the mechanisms to allow for greater awareness of those textbooks and easier discovery. So what we'll be providing access to are all of the materials that are available through the Open Textbook Network. The question is, how do we raise that awareness? How do we make it easier for our faculty to find those materials and to make the decision to employ them in their classes? And it's exactly that sort of best practices that we're hoping to learn through our work with OTN in order to bring up that awareness and then bring up that use.
Dave, for schools that have been part of the network for a couple of years, I know you all started 2 years ago. How does it work for schools that have been in the network for a year or two? Is it about, as Scott saying, faculty awareness, getting faculty aware that there are resources available for them that are part of their, they can use open textbooks where, and by open textbooks, that you know, where the textbooks are available online for free or for download? Is that sort of the biggest hurdle right now?
Absolutely. That was a very well said. It's all about education and awareness of faculty. Faculty make the decisions about what textbooks to use in their courses, and they should. They are the experts. And so it really just is letting them know that there is this option. And we hope that many times an open textbook is a real usable option, and that faculty then can see the benefit of using them, because it does, research has shown that 95% of the time using open resources, you end up with better student outcomes, which is what this is all about. So what we do in the in
I was just wondering, how many books is this? Is it common? Like, I don't know if there's a percentage of how many textbooks are available for open textbooks. I can't even imagine the number of textbooks that exist in the world, but I'm just wondering how many are available online for free.
Right. We have an open textbook library at open.umn.edu that has about just under 300 textbooks in it right now that are openly licensed, free to download. They've kind of sprung up around the internet, and we're just pointing to them and kind of making it as easy as possible for faculty to find them.
And what's the average cost for a school to join the network?
The average cost depends on some things, but about $5,000, which includes a couple of trainers heading out to the university, us bringing someone to Minnesota in the summer to train them, a staff person from the institution, some data collection. It doesn't actually pay our expenses. We are somewhat subsidized by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. We have a grant to get this going.
Go ahead.
Can I also mention the other end of that, which is the outcomes? Within the first year and a half, our networks have saved students about $3.1 million. That's a number we've reported through spring of 2016.
$3.1 million. Okay. And are you getting any kind of pushback, I imagine, from textbook publishers? Because I think people often tend to think that maybe the authors of the book, faculty that write textbooks, are making money off of textbooks. I'm not sure that's often the case. Is it more publishers that would maybe be a little more resistant to this?
To be honest, we haven't gotten a lot of pushback from anybody. Publishers continue to do what they do, and they have businesses that are working for them. Faculty authors, actually, what I hear more often from faculty authors is frustration because once they publish a commercial textbook, they lose control of it. And oftentimes, what I hear is frustration that the cost of their own textbook is so high. So no, to be honest, there is very little pushback from anywhere.
And Scott, I'm wondering for you with DePaul University, what you hear from students about the cost of textbooks. I mentioned earlier, we've been talking to University of Illinois students on Reddit about this issue this morning. And one user told us they're taking a class that requires them, this is apart from the textbooks, it requires them to buy an online code to do the homework, so they can't pirate the book online. And so the student has to pay about $80 just to access their homework. Another student told us they're paying several hundred per semester for that access. I wonder, are you seeing textbook companies finding new ways to charge students as the students are sort of working around trying to find books online?
I think you'll certainly find that publishers have worked to develop licensed content that goes along with their texts, and that may be both to circumvent the sort of online use that you're mentioning. It also has an impact on the used textbook market. So if you're able to, in the old days, back when I worked for a university bookstore, we would take in a number of texts at the end of every semester, and those would be available for resale as used books. As you have that licensed content or that controlled content available behind a password that's attached to a particular text and is used in a particular class, of course, that doesn't travel along the same path as a used textbook might have in the past. So it is, I think, certainly a way of helping to capture that market and to control some of the even traditional mechanisms for controlling textbook costs, which we used to do through a used textbook market or textbook exchanges.
Dave, are there any plans? It might be for people who aren't college students or don't have college students that they know well, it might be surprising to them that in addition to students having to pay for textbooks, they have to pay for these online homework portal fees. Is that something that you all have thought about adding, or are you kind of focusing on textbooks right now to alleviate that cost?
We're focusing on textbooks right now. I think that's a whole nother level of technical capacity and services that I don't think we're ready to address. But we're really focused on textbooks, for sure.
And do you find in particular, Dave, that there are specific departments or areas of expertise where faculty are more likely to use open textbooks? If so, what areas would those be?
If you look on the Open Textbook Library, you'll see a wide range of content and courses that these books might align to. But they're not really. But although I would say that, say, math and the hard sciences, especially math, tend to have quite a few open textbooks available, so lots of choices. And so there may be a few more there.
Dave, are you all, as you're thinking about integrating this and introducing this to the DePaul University campus, I'm sorry, Scott, as you're thinking about integrating this for DePaul, are there specific departments that you're trying to do, or is your goal to do this campus-wide?
We are definitely taking a campus-wide view. So to date, we have a faculty advisory committee here at the university for the library. That it goes across all of our colleges and schools. I spoke last month with our academic council, which is our deans, directors, vice presidents, all of whom report in through the provost's office. We talked about this, again, as part of an institutional initiative. And I think that's for two reasons. First, even in our initial discussions after the Student Government Association first came to me last spring and asked what the library could do to help move this discussion along, I immediately started to hear from faculty from a number of colleges who were either already doing work in this area, maybe already had authored an open textbook, or were using an open textbook, and that came from across different colleges.
Ah, okay. I'm afraid we're out of time. Oh. Really quickly, though, just when do you have a sense that it will be implemented? Would this be something next year?
This is something we will be working on very actively over the coming year. As I said, I've spoken with deans. I've begun to speak with my advisory group. And
okay, great. Thank you so much for that.
Right.
Yeah, Scott Walter with DePaul University, Dave Erst with the Open Textbook Network. Thank you. Welcome back to the 21st. On Monday, we like to talk politics with other Illinois journalists. Joining us today from NPR's Chicago Bureau is correspondent David Shaper, and from Springfield, the Associated Press's State House correspondent Ivan Moreno. David, Ivan, hey guys, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
David, news over the weekend, very sad news in Chicago, the death of longtime professor and political pundit Paul Green. He was 73. He'd been the director of the Institute for Politics at Roosevelt University. Previously, he'd been at Governor's State. I know he was also chairman of the City Club of Chicago. David, I know you've said this was the guy who, a familiar voice for public radio listeners, especially in Chicago, the guy who knew all the personalities, all the factions within parties, not just in Chicago, but in Illinois politics.
You know, what struck me about Paul and his analysis about politics is he never took sides, partisan-wise, and he was a realist. He understood the real costs and consequences as well as the reality of forging alliances within political factions, within the political parties. He was great at breaking down how well at times Illinois Democrats and Republicans could work together, while some in the media would call that the great Illinois combine of bipartisan combine that screwed taxpayers over, in the words of one columnist here. He understood why things like that had to be done and broke down both the benefits and the drawbacks of things like that. I found him enormously practical about why politics was so important and how it impacted our lives.
And David, I know you also said this weekend your interviews with him would go much longer than you guys had originally planned.
He was a funny guy, and he always had little quips and just really funny things to say about certain races, and he would try them different ways to make it the perfect soundbite for us. And he was a political analyst on WGN Radio. I should bring this up just for the simple point of, you know, he had an arrangement there to be their guy, and so others in the broadcast media would stay away from him, but he always made time for public radio, for WBEZ when I worked there, for NPR now, for all the other stations around the state, and I think he. he really appreciated what we brought to the table in terms of depth and trying to really dig deeper into stories, but he still wanted to have those funny little quips, those little witty things that he would say about.
Can you remember, David? Can you think of some of your favorite ones?
I'm looking at a couple that Cranes had pulled out because he wrote occasional columns for Crane's Chicago Business. One time he said about Mike Madigan and Republicans' efforts to try to loosen his control of the state house. This is after, in the 1990s, listeners may recall that, you know, Republicans got control to make the map, and they made it in their favor after the 1990 census. It really didn't happen until the 1994 elections, but there was one term where Lee Daniels, the Illinois Republican leader, the House Republican leader, became Speaker of the House, and Mike Madigan was the minority party leader. And he won it back in just 2 years. And the entire decade, the state Senate stayed in Republican control. And Madigan's firm grip was impossible for, and still is, Republicans to break. So he wrote in 2000, as they're getting ready to maybe remap again, unless Republicans can find a way to place Mr. Madigan's district in Wisconsin, his control of the Illinois House looks solid no matter which party draws the next legislative map, which is still apropos today.
Right, especially as we've seen the whole conversations about redistricting even in the past month.
Even Governor Rauner dumping tons of money into a race against a Madigan opponent who did just as poorly as every other opponent of Mike Madigan does in his individual state house.
Mm-hmm. And Ivan, in fact, you have a story out today. We'll tweet that out so everyone can see. If you follow 21st Show, it's a bit of a flip how much Republicans are outspending Democrats in state races. And Ivan, your reporting shows it's all because of Governor Rauner.
Yeah, it's all because of the money that he has really the capacity to contribute, because, I mean, he's a very wealthy former venture capitalist. And so far, he has given the Illinois Republican Party Committee a total of about $16 million, $13 million of which that committee has already distributed to candidates in races all across the state. And what makes this very significant is that this is really the first time in recent history where we have seen this flip, where Republicans actually have more spending power than Democrats, because this is a blue state. Typically, you see Democrats being more successful in fundraising. And as Representative Jim Durkin, the Republicans' House leader, told me, this is the first time where he has seen House Republicans outspending House Democrats. And obviously, this is allowing Republicans to compete in more races, to compete earlier in these races, which they have not had the luxury to do in the past. And just to put this into context, this money that Rauner has invested so far, in 2012, before Rauner, the Illinois Republican Committee, the same committee that now has $16 million from Rauner, spent a total of $3.4 million.
Wow, so we're looking at more than four times the amount from the last cycle. Ivan, where are we seeing this money being concentrated right now? What races in particular are we seeing? Are Illinois Republicans concentrating specific areas, Chicago suburbs, downstate? Where are we seeing most of this money being put in?
Well, you're really seeing it all over the place. I mean, just and some of them are in Chicago suburbs. For instance, there's this Republican incumbent, Republican Michael McAuliffe, who is being targeted by Democrats. He has already gotten about $1 million from this money that Rauner has deposited on these committees. And you're seeing television ads airing even outside of his district since August. I mean, both of which are obviously extremely rare. You're also seeing races in southern Illinois where Republicans are targeting incumbent Democrat John Bradley with a gentleman by the name of Dave Severin. And so Severin has gotten most of his $300,000 are all from Rauner's money that he's contributed to these committees. So that's why it's so significant. I mean, these
candidates otherwise would be at a significant disadvantage. Severin, for instance, is going up against Bradley, who himself, you know, has just over $647,000. So this has really given Republicans
lots of money in these races. Yeah. Ivan, what about the Illinois Comptroller's race? Is it a surprise? And David, I would love you to weigh in after this. Mm-hmm. Is it a surprise, Ivan, that this race is competitive, or just that people are paying such close attention to the Comptroller's race?
Yes and no. I mean, typically this is a race that is not, you know, the sexiest races that you see around. But this time it really kind of has become this sort of proxy battle between Republicans, Rauner specifically, and Democrats. You know, we have Michael Madigan being invested in the person challenging Munger, Susana Mendoza, and this is also a very expensive race so far. Munger has $320,000 already in total funds, and Mendoza has almost $1.4 million. So, yeah, very unusual that there's just a lot of money, but this is just kind of both parties jockeying for being able to consolidate their power at the state house.
David, you know, I was thinking so much of the time, we had Judy Bartopinka in that office for so long, maybe that might be why also we haven't paid as much attention to that race. I wonder your thoughts on how much you think this is a proxy for Governor Rauner and Speaker Madigan and the whole budget situation.
I think it's a proxy for the governor's battle against Mike Madigan, certainly, but I also think it's a bigger battle between the Republican Party's efforts to pick away and chip away at the Democratic stronghold, even beyond Mike Madigan, that Illinois has become. It seems like from what I've been seeing so far is that Bruce Rauner is trying to make, first and foremost, the Republican Party a little bit different from what it's been in the past in Illinois, much more business-friendly and free market approach, not playing the same old games that George Ryans and Jim Edgars and Jim Thompsons did in decades past, in terms of, you know, trying to cozy up with Democrats and trying to get along on certain issues and have their differences and their battles on other issues. He's much more fiercely independent in a way than we've seen with the Republican Party of the past. Yet the National Party seems to be going in a different direction from that entirely too. I mean, there are some similarities if you look towards to the approach that Rauner is taking in Illinois to, say, Scott Walker in Wisconsin, or in Ohio and other states. But at the same time, I mean, you look at some of the conservatives, Ted Cruz and others in the U.S. Senate, others in the U.S. House, and certainly where Donald Trump is going, it's kind of hard to figure out what the Republican Party of Illinois is all about in this landscape to some degree.
And David, while we have you here, you are NPR's correspondent based in the Chicago Bureau. You're all over in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. What races are you paying attention to throughout the Midwest? What else should we be looking at?
You know, I think control of the U.S. Senate is certainly a big, big matter. And I think we've seen in of the House as well, but the Senate is certainly much closer in the body that is likely to flip. So we have that race here in Illinois, Tammy Duckworth against Mark Kirk, which a lot of pundits seem to expect Duckworth to win pretty easily. But I think it's a really close race. Some of the polling shows him a little bit apart. But, you know, Mark Kirk has done a pretty fair job over the years of making himself well known as a very moderate Republican and someone who Democrats are comfortable with. We saw it 6 years ago when he won this seat, pretty narrowly, but he won it in a Democratic state. Others in Wisconsin, the race, again, a second battle between Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson. Ron Johnson unseated Feingold in 2010. Mm-hmm. It was a big Republican sweep up there that year. Feingold leads narrowly in polls to try to reclaim his seat.
Oh, that'll be really interesting. He's always a long-time, very popular politician in Wisconsin as well.
He has been, but he's not doesn't have the staying power. And the Wisconsin Republican Party has done an amazing job building an incredible ground game. That again, if they can separate themselves from the Trump campaign and not be tied down to that, it's a state that should go for Hillary Clinton by a pretty wide margin. The question is whether or not people will split their ballots.
Right, an interesting question about the same question you could pose here with Hillary Clinton, with Secretary Clinton, and with Senator Kirk.
Right, right. So yeah, there's a few other very close races in the Midwest. I think we've got a Senate race now in Indiana where we might not have had one before. The Midwest is really going to be a battleground, a real testing ground for both parties, and to kind of figure out who controls not just the White House but Congress.
Thanks very much to David Shaper, NPR correspondent from their Chicago bureau. Thanks also to Ivan Moreno, supervisory correspondent with the Associated Press from his office in the State House. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Thanks for having me.
A few weeks ago, we had Chicago artist Rhymefest on our show to talk about a video he took of his interaction with the Chicago Police Department that went viral. He had been robbed. He went in to report the incident, and how officers responded to him was part of that video. He wrote a song called Cops and Robbers a few hours later. This weekend, he dropped another song calling from citizens of Chicago to believe in a better community. This has become a nationwide story. We've had the Chicago Police Department apologize to him. Rhymefest has also been talking about the conversations he's had with Chicago PD and the mayor. In an op-ed he wrote for Crane's Chicago Business, he's calling for a citywide truth and reconciliation program, which he says will call for the communities to listen to each other's stories and understand each other while we're talking about police officers or citizens. You can see the full conversation that we had with Rhymefest. It's online at www.21stshow.org. We've also put it up on Facebook. We just tweeted out. If you search for us there, you can look for the 21st on Facebook to like us. Follow us on Twitter at 21stshow. And here's a little bit of Rhymefest's new song. It's called Believe.
I don't believe in wrong or right. I don't believe the devil's home tonight. I question the existence of a Jesus Christ. Tell me, how did that man die twice? My homie got shot once and ain't come back to life. I don't believe in karma. You don't believe me? Ask my baby mama. She's just mad because we ain't believe in condoms. I was blindfolded by blind faith. Trust in these bars, they snakes. Open your eyes. You got Medusa on a blind date. For no man will time wait. I'm bowler. Do something about these crooked cops and the crime rate. They call us 3/5 of a human. That's a primate. I don't believe we came from monkeys, that's a mind state. I don't believe the sagging pants is the problem. You can pull them all the way up, you still jobless. Or get a record deal and even make $1 million. Still behind on child support and eating garbage. I don't believe in Kwanzaa February. I don't believe affirmative action is necessary. I don't believe that education can educate. I learn more as a shorty on 55th estate. I learn more from the melanin given to my face. Just learn to end on phase 3, I'm losing faith. Like a bird with a broken wing and a half a leg. And nobody at the nest with a cracked egg. The fortune teller said in my future was leadership. But if she told me the rest, I wouldn't believe her. If I got a daughter I don't ever see, I guess that means she don't believe in me. What's the truth to a liar? Baptism. When the devil's in the choir, they turn the gospel into fire. Let it burn, let it burn, let it burn, let it burn, let it burn. I went from ugly and broke to rich and handsome. Life is random, the right price to take your belief for ransom. I believe in violence, I believe money can buy silence. I believe I'm traumatized by sirens. Of this story, I believe in our story. I believe that my ancestors are down to rob us. So I say what I please and create what you need. I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees. When your family hurt you, when your homies desert you, when they tell you it's business, but you taking it personal. Yeah, I'm taking it personal. All the verses I burnt you, when that money you burnt through, tell me what is it hurt you. When the industry turns you straight fake like a perm do, when the hood you was raised in, don't even consider.
That's Grammy and Oscar award-winning Chicago-based artist and social activist Rhymefest, his latest song, Believe. Coming up on the 21st, we're going to be talking about dog and human communication. Maybe you saw that study about how dogs can understand not just our word and our tone. We're also going to flip that and ask, are we paying enough attention to how dogs are trying to communicate with us? You're listening to the 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you have a dog, do you wonder whether he understands what you're saying? You may have seen the headlines recently saying your dog understands not just your tone, but also your words. That's according to a new study. We're joined now by veterinary behaviorist from the University of Illinois. Dr. Kelly Ballantyne joins us on the line from Chicago. Dr. Ballantyne, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do we know about how much dogs understand what people are saying to them?
Well, you know, based on the results of that new study that was just published, you know, what they determined was that the dogs could process both the words and the tone of our voice, and they could do so independently. And then they also kind of combined the two, so they can combine word and tone. So like when the experimenters were using praising words with praising tones of voice, that had the strongest effect, at least in the, like, the dog's brain reward centers. So that was a pretty neat finding.
Well, and it's also a little conventional, contradictory to conventional wisdom, right? Because I think we tend to think when you talk to an animal, especially a dog, if you're using the right tone, that's all that matters. But how did they actually figure out that words make a difference?
So, well, their study design was really interesting. So they used a couple of different conditions. So they had praise words with a praising tone of voice, and then they had praise words in a neutral tone of voice, and then they used the neutral words with that praising tone, and then just the neutral words with the neutral tone. And the dogs were, their brains definitely responded more to the praising words, which were probably words that they were really familiar with, when given that praising tone of voice. And even like when they used the neutral words with a praising tone of voice, the dog's brains did not respond as strongly.
Dr. Ballantyne, I'm probably going to offend some dog owners here, but I noticed that the dogs in the study were, to my mind, pretty intelligent dogs because there were border collies and German shepherds. They're dogs that we know that have been well-trained to interact with humans. And to, does it matter? Do different breeds have different levels of, I'm not going to say intelligence, but maybe vocabulary comprehension?
I don't know that we know the answer to that. I mean, we've bred dogs for different work, right? So like, as you mentioned, retrievers are really bred to pay attention to their handlers, whereas, you know, the hounds are really bred to go out and act independently. So that might look like their intelligence is different. You know, hounds are often considered to be stubborn or maybe not that smart, but it's possible that that's just, they just think about things differently.
Right. So do we think that it's actually, it isn't just your intonations, it is the actual words that matter in the sense that there are certain words the dogs really can understand?
Well, I really think it probably also really depends on the dog's experience. So if you're using, you know, the same word in the same context, I think a lot of dogs will pick up or at least, in, you know, guess the meaning of what that word means. But if you're using random words all the time, it might be hard for them to learn what we're saying.
How do you think this new study builds on our previous understanding about how dogs do you actually process human languages?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the other studies have investigated the tone that we use, and we know that our tone of speech does definitely affect the dog's behavior, and specifically when we're using really strong emotions. So if we're really happy or we're angry, they tend to pick up on that a lot better than if we're just using a neutral tone of voice. And then we also know that dogs can learn, you know, the name of an object by even just watching two humans talking about an object in conversation. But in that study or in that kind of line of investigation, what they thought was probably happening was that the dog was picking up on the other cues that the humans were using, like looking at the object a lot, and they did a lot better if the people were looking at the object while also talking about it.
Well, and it was interesting. I was having a conversation with a friend about this recently, about how they speak to their dog in different languages. Does that make a difference? Does language matter to dogs? Or is it just, again, they're sort of picking up the contextual clues as well as the words, and it doesn't really matter what language it's in?
Yeah, so I think the context is really what's most important. And certainly, like, we also have a lot of clients where they will teach their dog specific cues in a different language. And I think as long as you're using the consistent word, the dog will be able to pick up on what the owner means. So language doesn't necessarily matter. I think it's more of the consistency.
And when we think about pet owners who want to increase their dog's vocabulary, what's the best way to do that? Is it constant training and repetition and being clear about the context?
Yes, that is certainly very, very helpful in teaching dogs what words mean, or at least what we're trying to imply that they mean. I think one of the situations that a lot of dog owners run into is they will use the same word in different contexts, and the best example I can get is, come when called. And so owners will say, come, and sometimes come means you come over here and I give you a treat or I give you some affection, and then sometimes come means you come over here and I take you away from the dog park, or you come over here and, you know, I bring you into the bathroom and give you a bath. So I think if you want a consistent response from the dog, you want to use it in a very consistent context and always have a desirable consequence for that as well.
Dr. Ballantyne, in the study, the authors made a distinction between processing language and understanding it. What's the difference, right, do you think, for you, especially as we're thinking about dogs or other animals, and processing versus understanding language?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Understanding really implies, at least to me, comprehension of what the word means, whereas processing language means their brains were responding to specific words. So their brains, you know, lit up when the familiar words were used, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they understood that, you know, the praising the good boy meant that they know that the meaning of the words good and boy.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be similar to, like, I guess the best example I could give is that, you know, if you're in a foreign country and you're hearing a language that you've never heard before, you might start picking up certain words that have been repeated and you can recognize those words, but you don't necessarily know what those words mean.
Right. And so when some people say, for example, that dogs have a comparable vocabulary to a human toddler, is that accurate?
Well, there have been a couple of studies, and, you know, they were both with border collies, where those dogs seem to have very extensive vocabularies. You know, one dog, he could recognize at least 200 different words and identify, or he chose the correct object when given the word, the name of that object. There was another study with another border collie where that dog seemed to understand over 1,000 words.
Mm.
So they learned the names for specific objects, but I still think that that's different than actually understanding language.
And where do dogs rank compared to, say, cats or birds when it comes to processing language?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that birds are really well known for processing or recognizing human words, like mm-hmm. the bird Alex. There have been a lot of studies about. He was also able to identify specific named objects. I don't believe that there's been any work on cats and how good they are at identifying named objects. I have a feeling if they were trained to do so, that they would be, that they could do it.
Right. Well,
I don't know how they would compare.
Right. Well, you'd have to train the cat. And it was so interesting in the study, right, because they trained the dogs to lie quietly in an MRI machine and not move. I don't know if you could do that with cats.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if anybody has tried yet.
Dr. Ballantyne, we've been talking about how humans communicate with dogs, but what we haven't talked about is if humans are good at understanding dog communication. What do you think about that?
You know, communication is not just a one-way street, and I really feel like, you know, we focus a lot on how much dogs understand about us, but then I think we miss really trying to understand what dogs are trying to tell us with their, not only with their barks, but also with their body language. While we're good at identifying, like, big signals of concern, such as growling, snapping, or biting, we tend to miss the more subtle signs when our dogs are feeling distressed, and that can be, you know, something as simple as them turning their head away or leaning their way or pulling their ears back and licking their lips.
So I think you, by that token, you think, how can we be better attuned to communicating with our dogs?
Exactly. And so I think, you know, there are a lot of really wonderful resources out there for dog lovers and dog owners to learn about how dogs communicate. And I really feel like that's a great way to deepen their relationships with their dogs. Dogs can be pretty subtle. So, you know, things that might indicate that they're feeling uncomfortable or, you know, that they don't want to interact, such as turning their head away or lip licking or yawning, aren't necessarily on our human radars. So we miss that. And then we don't, you know, we don't recognize that the dog is feeling uncomfortable maybe until they get to the point where they're growling or showing their teeth. So I think really learning about their language can help us and clear up a lot of communication misunderstandings.
So what resources or how do you recommend that people learn more about better communicating with their dogs, not in, I guess, human language, but in dog language?
Right, in dog language. So there's a really wonderful website called Dog On Safe. That has some excellent resources, some visual resources for dog owners. There's also a really excellent YouTube video called, it's made by The Family Dog, and it's called What Your Dog is Desperately Trying to Tell You. And it's great because it shows a combination of both expressions of what we would call happiness and also expressions of, you know, discomfort or fear. So I think those would be two really good places to get people started.
What are common expressions that dogs make that humans may not be familiar with for expressions of maybe happiness or comfort?
Well, I think, you know, the happiness, I think we're actually pretty good at recognizing, and that's usually like loose body posture, you know, floppy lips with the mouth, you know, slightly open and the tail lolling out. Sometimes they even almost look like they're smiling. And then, you know, the tail wag, which is something that a lot of people will like kind of take as always a positive signal, can actually be a mixed message. So if we have a low soft tail wag, that is usually, you know, a friendly gesture. But if we have, you know, a really stiff or rapid tail wag, then that can actually just be a sign of arousal, and dogs can often, you know, be barking and growling while wagging their tail. But the intent is definitely that they're feeling distressed and aroused, and you know, you wouldn't want to interact with a dog that was wagging its tail in that manner combined with those other signals.
That said, is it true that I saw some headlines recently about how most dogs are sad or stressed when they're being held, and we may think that maybe they're happy about it, but they're not?
Right. So yeah, I mean, and I think that certainly there are plenty of dogs out there that probably enjoy physical contact with their owners, but certainly we see a lot of dogs where the owner is enjoying the interaction, but the dog is using those subtle signals like turning their head away, leaning slightly away, licking their lips, their ears are pulled back. So they're using their communication to say, I'm uncomfortable, I want this to stop. And so the best way I feel like to interact with our dogs is to, you know, pay attention to their body language during those interactions and make sure that they're enjoying it just as much as we are.
Right, because I think when you're thinking about dogs versus cats, it's pretty clear when a cat does not want to be held, or cats are maybe a little more obvious in their communication than dogs are, I guess you would say, right?
They can be, although they have some subtle signals that they're uncomfortable too before they get to that point. But they're actually even more subtle than dogs.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Dr. Kelly Ballantyne is a veterinary behaviorist with the University of Illinois. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be speaking with photographer Larry Kampfer about his latest work. It's called A Prairie State of Mind. It's a collection of his photographs. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links and every other way to contact us, whether it's phone, email, or social media, is all at our website, www.21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman, Philip Kisabika, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.